are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 15th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at University of Rhode Island, writer at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, Eric Loomis, on a history of America in 10 strikes. Also on the program today, Trump settling on the Ed Whelan Khashoggi lie. Maybe it was a rogue, unknown assailant.
It's the same guy. It's the same guy.
Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren releases a DNA test, and a charity awaits Trump's $1 million.
Checks in the mail.
Gavin McGinnis providing a cautionary tale of getting bumped out of your soon-to-be-famous magazine has gone full brown shirt with his crew. Meanwhile, Donald Trump looking at a new family separation terror program. Jared Kushner has paid no taxes for years. And YouTube turns out to be the number one online fascist recruiter, according to a new report. Donald Trump, surprise, surprise, still a climate change denier. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, quite a weekend for the brown shirts. In New York City. And we will get to that. Gavin McGinnis is no longer on Twitter anymore, so I don't have any way to sort of reach out and mock him. I am unfortunately not on Instagram. And or to the extent that I don't think I have an account. I think I may have set one up to follow my daughter, but I couldn't figure
surveillance
it out.
Account?
Yeah, exactly. But that was nuts. We have video from that, and it has been sort of interesting to me. I mean, I know Gavin peripherally socially from back in the day, and it is amazing what some people will do for money. It really is shocking,
and even just attention.
And well, attention and money. I mean, I think that's
on a continuum.
It's the attention economy.
Yeah, he got bought out of Vice, and that made him rich already. So whatever he did after that was probably for attention and power.
He did get bought out of Vice, but not even for a fraction of what they ultimately made. Like, I mean, if the difference, I mean, that's what's got to be eating him, I think.
Oh,
ultimately.
Certainly.
We'll talk more about this. Is that, you know, yeah. He walked away from Vice probably more money than he ever imagined he would make doing that. But the amount of money that those people who pushed him out made relative to him, I think, dwarfed him in such a way that it clearly made him feel just embarrassed, less than, probably for a guy like that who commingles his sense of masculinity with those type of things. I imagine it is a humiliation that he has never gotten over. And we're watching it. This is what happens, I think, is that you see for people who start off already with some, you know, mental deficiencies, when they lose out, when they see the brass ring and they are about to grab it, and then their friends sort of push him out and grab it, and then walk around, and then the brass ring turns into like a massive brass ring, and then some other metal that's even more valuable than brass. And then you watch that from afar, and you realize you're not, you don't have like the skill set to achieve what they achieved or what your other friends achieved, then you just go for whatever, wherever there's a vacuum. You know, water finds its lowest, the lowest level, that type of thing. And it's fascinating to watch. I don't think it ends well for him. I don't think so, but we shall see. I mean, if I was him, I might check out ZipRecruiter. Get a real job. There are job sites that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through or make you wait for the right candidates to apply to your job. That's not smart. But you know what is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Isn't that right, Brendan? Nodding over there, who we found. We should really just make you like wear a t-shirt that says the ZipRecruiter guy, because that's where we found him. Or I should say that's where he found us. That was not in the contract. It's powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, actively invites them to apply so you get qualified candidates fast. Is that what happened to you?
Yeah.
It is honestly what happened to you. Were you on a different site or something? What? Yeah, where'd they find you?
Well, I signed up, and then they sent a bunch of
okay. jobs. Okay, awesome. No more sorting through the wrong resumes. No more waiting for the right candidates to apply. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Folks, I will tell you, as a small business owner, the best time to do one of these searches is when you don't need to hire somebody. Because somebody walks in here, says to me, Sam, I got another gig. I'm going to go in 2 weeks. Actually, you know what? They need me in 6 days. That's what happens every time. And then you're left in the lurch. The best time to look for someone is when you don't need to hire them. It's when it's not an emergency. At ZipRecruiter.com/majority, ZipRecruiter.com/majority, ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So Elizabeth Warren, it really appears. It was a story in the Boston Globe earlier, just a couple of days ago. I think this was in the Washington Post. That had written about her expansive campaign effort ahead of a likely 2020 bid. And it outlined what her campaign was doing, not just for her, but in terms of other candidates across the country. I mean, there really does seem to be an awareness. And I think, you know, most politicians know this. Like I read that Cory Booker has sent out a lot of his campaign staff to go help people running in Iowa as a way of getting a jump in Iowa. What Warren's doing is seems to be a little bit more comprehensive and broad, but there does seem to be, at least more explicitly and more overt, the Democrats are understanding, like, you got to build coalitions even before you get elected. You see that with AOC, for instance, and with Bernie. Have been doing this. And I think that is just as a practice, never mind from an ideological standpoint, as a practice, they've introduced that notion of solidarity. It is obviously easier to maintain when you are you're pushing a more ideological set of solutions rather than one that is based on what is expedient for the different people involved, because expediency tends to dissolve solidarity. Nevertheless, Warren, I think as part of a preparation to run, took one of those DNA tests. And who asked her to take that test? Well, of course, it was Donald Trump who had been for years calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, based upon what Scotty B in his losing to Elizabeth Warren back in the U.S. Senate race in Massachusetts started. Here is Donald Trump talking about that. This was back in July.
I'm going to get one of those little kids. And in the middle of the debate, when she proclaims that she's of Indian heritage because her mother said she has high cheekbones. That's her only evidence, that her mother said she had high cheekbones. We will take that little kid and say, but we have to do it gently. Because we're in the Me Too generation, so we have to be very gentle. And we will very gently take that kid and we will slowly toss it, hoping it doesn't hit her and injure her arm, even though it only weighs probably 2 ounces. And we will say, I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump.
Pause it for 1 second. What's interesting about the way he does this, like, right, he's trying to set her up as weak, trying to set her up as a liar.
Frail. She's going to be so frail, it's people are going to get feel sorry for her.
Trying to set himself up as rich. I mean, these the Trumpistas, all of this, they love it. It feeds into every single pre-existing prejudice that they have. But continue.
Paid for by Trump. If you take the test and it shows you're an Indian, you know. And let's see what she does, right? I have a feeling she will say no. But we'll hold that for the debates. Do me a favor. Keep it within this room.
Well, it turns out somebody didn't keep it within that room. And Elizabeth Warren took a DNA test. And it confirms that, I mean, to the extent that, look, these DNA tests, I don't know how accurate they are. My understanding is that not necessarily terribly. But this is politics, folks. It doesn't matter if she has any Native American ancestry. She never used it to get a job. It doesn't matter. She has that idea. It came from her mom. Her mom may or may not have known what she was talking about. It doesn't matter. Except for the ridiculous politics that we have. And frankly, it's even less about proving it to the voters and more about proving it to the media. The reason why she's doing this now is to make sure that editors 6 months from now, when they're writing stories, say to their don't say to their reporters, like, get me an angle on the Native American thing. This puts it to bed early in the process. It's very smart. Not to mention, it's also, I can't imagine the Republican Party wants to be running on right now. Elizabeth Warren isn't as much of an Indian as we thought she was.
The closing right, this argument is a closing for the argument. Midterms.
Exactly. So the test reveals that she has some tiny amount of Native American heritage. I mean, that's the story. Whether the DNA test is accurate or not is wholly irrelevant. The story is that the DNA test shows that she has some ancestry. And here is Donald Trump having to lie and hope that there's no video. Maybe he just forgot that he said this, which is quite possible. Yeah, I mean, but here is Trump. He's leaving with he's saying that Pompeo is leaving for Saudi Arabia within an hour to find the genuine killer of Khashoggi. Right. This is his if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit moment. But here he is being asked about Elizabeth Warren.
Are you reacting to Senator Elizabeth Warren releasing the results of her DNA test?
No, I have no. Who cares?
Mr. President, you said you paid $1 million to charity.
I didn't say that.
I'm quite convinced he did win that. And Elizabeth Warren has already announced which charity she wants it to go to. Do we have the she writes, by the way, Donald Trump, remember saying on July 5th that you'd give $1 million to a charity of my choice. My DNA showed Native American ancestry. And here's the verdict. Please send the check to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
No.
The NIWRC. I don't think he's going to send that check.
I'll send my own
check. I already sent them money this year.
Yeah, I already sent them money. Exactly. Yeah. I'll send them money, but not because I'm being extorted, because I care about the value.
The only reason why I'm not going to send money is because it's not tax deductible, because I don't pay taxes. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Eric Loomis.
It's all deductible. Everything's deductible.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure, I believe, to welcome back to the program Eric Loomis. He is an associate professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and author of his latest, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
All right, so you weave a story throughout of 10 strikes that tell the story of the U.S. Union movement. And there are two basic, I think, broad strokes about your book that it shows us. The first is that unions must, I guess, synthesize and engage in a struggle against racism and sexual equality. And without that engagement, they are doomed to fail. Which of those strikes, those 10 that you go through, exhibit that the most?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, if you look through American labor history, that one of the things that we really see, unfortunately, you know, when we ask about why do, you know, people often ask on the left, why does the working class vote against their interests? But you know, and they mean that in terms of voting for, say, Republican politicians like Donald Trump, who are not going to help them. And yet you see, large swaths of the white working class, as well as, you know, white people generally, voting for Republican candidates. And you know, the reason is that they are voting for their interests. They're voting for their white interests over their class interests. And so I think that in terms of thinking about, especially, you know, post 2016, what are the issues that we face? This is one of them, right? That the working class divides itself over race, and oftentimes when it succeeds, it does so by overcoming that. I mean, I think one great example of how it does overcome that is in the last chapter, where I talk about justice for janitors, where these incredible strikes in Los Angeles in the early 1990s that expand across the country of janitors, where, you know, the Service Employees International Union really creates a multiracial movement that unites workers of all races who are working as janitors, white, African American, and Latino, in using these really incredible, innovative actions that force these big building companies to agree to new janitorial contracts that vastly improve the conditions for these workers. And I think that that's a counterpoint to too often in the past, where, you know, you see, for instance, you know, as I often point out, the first law that the United States Congress passes that really comes out of the labor movement, that's a major law in American history, is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which came out of the California labor movement by white workers who wanted to keep California white. And so I think that we see this over and over again, that the union movement is going to be successful in this country again. I think a critical component of that is that it fights for racial justice and doesn't allow a class to be divided by race.
You know, it just brings to mind, we interviewed the author, I think his name was Robin Kelly, of Hammer and Ho, which was about communists in Alabama in, I think it was in the 1920s. And the big roadblock to organizing just broadly unions at that time was race. And that's also, you write, explains why we have no unions in the South, so to, more or less. I mean, to the just touch on that.
Yeah, it's still a critical issue today. I mean, 1946, the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which had organized the big factories of the North, they realized that the only way they're going to be able to survive long term is if they can organize the South, because they know that companies will close those northern plants and move to the South, which, of course, is exactly what happens. But the organizing effort fails on the issue of race, that in white communities in the South, white working class communities, unions get associated with civil rights. They get associated with being Jewish. They get associated with socialism. And this becomes a powerful tool that the elite classes are able to use to make white workers suspicious of a organization that will potentially attack their beloved white supremacy. And the Operation Dixie organizing attempts in the late 40s largely fail. Black workers are far more interested in organizing than white workers. But in order to try to counter this fear that the unions equal civil rights, the CIO actually plays down its racial democracy, turning off those African-American workers and still not attracting the white workers. And, you know, you see it again in 2014 in that effort to organize the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where even though Volkswagen International actually wanted the union to get the German unions off their backs, the workers of that Chattanooga plant voted down the opportunity to organize with the United Auto Workers after a large-scale outside campaign by conservatives to taint the union as something that had ruined Detroit, using all of this racially charged imagery of a black Detroit to say this is what was going to happen to Chattanooga if they voted in the union, as if the UAW was responsible for the decline of Detroit, which is absolutely not true. But it's still very, very powerful in America today.
Well, all right. So what is the, I mean, in that regard, like, what is the answer there? I mean,
yeah, there's no easy answer. But the only potential way forward is for unions to be full throated in favor of equality of all kinds, because, you know, especially given the demographic reality of the United States today, and who really makes up the working class of the United States? It's African-Americans, it's Latinos, it's Asians, it's Native people, as well as working class whites. But in large parts of the country, working class whites are not a majority. And I think that, you know, fighting racism is a heck of a thing. I think that what you have to do is, you know, there's no evidence that trying to create a white working class strategy by playing down civil rights is going to be successful. There's plenty of evidence that it's not going to be successful. And I think what you have to do as a labor movement is give white workers reasons to, you know, to counter that identity that they have in favor of white supremacy. It's not going to attract all of them. I mean, you're not going to get the entire white working class to suddenly, you know, come over and support racial democracy. But you only need a relatively small number of them to make that switch, to have a huge political change in America, as well as to organize a lot of factories and a lot of other workplaces. And so anybody who's saying there's an easy answer to this is full of it, because there's not. But there's really no other choice other than to fight for racial democracy, because racial democracy and workplace democracy are really, in many ways, the same thing in a nation that is moving away from being majority white.
Right. And I guess, you know, obviously, racism's fairly durable. It seems to have lasted quite a while. But I guess the bottom line is you simply can't run from those issues, because it's a fool's errand is basically that's the starting point.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it just wouldn't work. I mean, fundamentally, it wouldn't work. You turn off the reality of who the working class actually is in the United States today, which is primarily people of color, while not actually attracting too many members of the white working class. If they already believe that union equals racial democracy and they're never going to support that, then you're not going to really appeal to them. But I think that if unions do work hard, and we as everyday citizens demand widespread economic justice in this nation, as well as widespread racial justice, that you you are going to have a good potential of creating a movement that is going to attract some of these people. I mean, we have to remember there were many, you know, white working class people who voted for Donald Trump, but then who also voted for Barack Obama. You know, they're not lost to us forever. And I think that they're, you know, this is part of a broader, I think, discussion about what kind of agenda can the left create that provides enough incentive for white people to, you know, to turn away from racism in order to realize that, you know, maybe they are, you know, maybe they do believe in white supremacy on some form or another, but they also believe in a bigger paycheck. And they actually believe that these institutions, whether it's unions or the Democratic Party or whatever, are going to actually provide that for them.
Let's talk about the other large message from your book, which is that the history of the union movement in this country, and maybe this is it's broader than this country, is that both long term and midterm, any type of major victories, sustainable, durable victories. Happen only if there is a government that is not actively working against unions. I mean, it could either be one that's favoring, but not actively working against them.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that I hope people get across. I mean, you know, a lot of union members express a lot of frustration and anger with the Democratic Party oftentimes, and I understand why. You know, too often the Democratic Party has not done what it needs to do, although it's worth noting that this gets back to the racial question. I mean, I often point to, you know, a couple of Democrats who the union movement was very disappointed with, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. But Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton rose to power without owing unions anything because unions were never able to organize Georgia and Arkansas, and that gets back to the racial question. But in terms of the broader issue, yeah, I mean, you know, you see a lot of people on the left respond to the problems of the Democratic Party sometimes by saying Democrats are worthless. We should start our own third party, or we should, you know, we're not going to support these Democrats. But and I understand the sentiment behind that. But the problem with it is that if we look at American labor history, there is almost no cases where unions have been able to succeed, or any of these strikes have been able to succeed, if the government and employers unite to crush that movement. The examples just don't exist. And even if we look to the earlier victories well before the New Deal, they almost always happen at a moment where either a president or a governor gets involved in that strike as a neutral agent rather than actively opposing the unions. And then, you know, unions only succeed in this country because workers themselves elect pro-labor politicians, both at the federal and at the state level, that allow that to happen. And so I, chapter 6 of my book focuses on the Flint sit-down strike, which is one of these incredibly iconic strikes of the United Auto Workers in Flint sitting down on the job and winning their, you know, first big contract with General Motors. And that establishes the UAW, the CIO, and really helps build the middle class. But part of the story there is that only happens because not only had workers elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt president twice in 32 and then again in 36, and he was pushing pro-labor legislation, but also they are able to elect a governor of Michigan named Frank Murphy, who was openly pro-union. Because when General Motors goes to the governor's office expecting the governor to mobilize the National Guard to kick those workers out, Frank Murphy says, no, he will not do that. 10 years earlier, that's exactly what would have happened. And so, you know, if these workers had not elected pro-labor politicians, they would not have won, no matter what their incredible, innovative moments of solidarity may have looked like. And so the part of the question we have to face is, how do we elect pro-worker politicians who will do the right thing? How do we gain enough power to force these politicians to do to act in favor of workers' rights? And I think that has to be part of our critical questions going forward as we seek a way out of the morass that we see in our current politics.
In the context of that point, just talked a little bit about Taft-Hartley. I mean, because that seems to be an example where the government was placed on almost a I don't want to say permanent, but pretty close to permanent non-neutral disposition towards unions.
Yes, absolutely. So 1947, you know, after these big strikes during the 1930s, and then a huge strike wave in 1946, that I focus on in the seventh chapter of the book, looking at the Oakland general strike, when millions of workers walk off the job, not for communism or radicalism, but really just because they want more money, because they haven't had a raise in 15 years, and you know they want to spend and they want union power, and this leads to a huge reaction that gets caught up in the anti-communism of the period. Where a law is created that greatly limits what unions can do, makes illegal many of the strategies that they had used to win those strikes of the 1930s, and allows states to become so-called right to work, which allows effectively workers to opt out of their unions and yet still be covered by those union contracts. It's very anti-labor. And this comes out of a critical point, though, which is that the union movement, as successful as it had been, was really only successfully organizing in a few states. So at that time, half of the members of the CIO are in only five states: Michigan, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New York, and Illinois. And so what that means is that in the U.S. Senate, where, you know, unions had tried to go down and organize in Georgia and Arkansas and North Carolina and all this and had failed, that you had openly anti-union politicians, and it was purely in their electoral interests to vote against unions, because unions were not popular in those states and they had not been able to successfully organize there. And so, for instance, in 1948, Lyndon Johnson wins his Senate seat in part by openly lying that his Senate opponent, who was the incumbent, was pro-union. LBJ was far more pro-union, but he knew to win in Texas, that was going to be the way to win. And so, you know, what happens is that because unions are unable to organize large parts of the country, and because the Senate is, you know, undemocratic, as we're discovering again today, it really opens the door for this kind of legislation that busts unions. And Harry Truman, the president, he vetoes that legislation as too extreme, and the Senate and House override that veto, wow, showing the real limits of union popularity at that time.
So, what's the response to that? I mean, we have been on a slow trajectory. I mean, obviously, there have been, I think, factors that have expedited the dismal state of unionization in this country at this point. I mean, we're down in the private sector to, I think, 6 or 7%. The public sector, you know, last I saw was probably around 30 something, but that could very well change in the wake of the Janus decision. Like, what can be done to deal with that? I mean, if your premise is correct, that we need a government that is not, at the very least, actively hostile to unions, what can be done in light of Taft-Hartley still existing?
Yeah, you know, what we have to do basically is to work as hard as we can to take over the Democratic Party and turn it into an organization that is going to support economic justice. And so, you know, I think that since 2016 and, you know, the rise of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others, I think that you're seeing a Democratic Party begin to respond to anger about inequality in a way that it hasn't in a very long time. And I think this is, you know, despite the structural disadvantages that we face and the fact that, yes, for a long time, unions have been slowly being eroded away. And then after Reagan takes power in 1981, that erosion becomes much, much faster, to the point that, you know, we have those kind of numbers of union density that you mentioned today. I think that the solution has to be is creating a Democratic Party that looks like a, you know, the left version of what the Republican Party looks like, an uncompromising force for economic justice. And I think that even in the year and a half, or now nearly 2 years since Donald Trump was elected, the Democratic Party has moved far to the left, and that these voices promoting ideas such as a federal job guarantee, for instance, free college tuition, and other things that are going to support, you know, that are going to support the working class, or have gained a lot of salience in the party. They haven't taken it over yet, but you know, this is a process that takes time, and I think that we're moving in the right direction. And so, you know, to some extent, the story of American labor might be a little pessimistic, and these are rough times. But I also think there are ways forward that can work and that are working. And moreover, we don't have a whole lot of other options. options except to use the leverages of power, the leverage of power that we can access in order to make that power work for us as much as we can. And so, you know, I feel modest, at least moderately optimistic, that a new conversation is happening, not only on the far left, but within, you know, standard Democratic Party politics that are moving us in the right direction.
How explicit? I mean, I don't feel like we hear explicit support for labor unions amongst Democratic politicians in the way that we may have, even just in terms of lip service, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. I mean, there was a time where, like, card check, right? Maybe it was going into 2008, where card check was a day one agenda item, supposedly, for the U.S. Senate. And I don't know if there was even ever a bill that was raised.
Yeah, you know, so yeah, I mean, basically, you know, among what everybody thought was going to get passed in 2009, when Obama and then, you know, an overwhelming Democratic Senate and House took power, was card check, which would have made it much easier to unionize. You wouldn't have had to go through a National Labor Relations Board election, which is a process that's been effectively captured by the employer, making it nearly impossible to win a traditional union election in many cases. And, you know, this would have allowed a victory if over 50% of workers in a bargaining unit had signed union cards, and this would have been a huge victory. And, you know, a couple things happen. I mean, I think that the Obama administration and Democratic Party's number one priority was the Affordable Care Act. And they use up basically all of their political capital to get that passed. And then, you know, I think what they did not anticipate, and what I don't think Obama ever quite realized until the very end of his second term, was just how strident the opposition was. And Mitch McConnell's choice to go basically destroy Senate norms in order to stop the Democratic Party from passing anything completely caught the Democratic Party off guard. And so things like not only card check, but the cap and trade bill and other major agendas that the parts of the progressive agenda that were supposed to come up never even got to a vote. So there was a bill for card check, but it never goes anywhere. And, you know, now, 10 years later, unions are even weaker than ever. The Supreme Court in the Janus decision just this last summer makes the public sector unions in our country even weaker. You're right. I mean, unions don't have the power that they used to. And this is a problem. And I think that one thing I want people to take from the book is that, you know, we don't know if the future of the worker struggle is really going to come through labor unions as they are, as they exist right now. They may well come in some other kind of form. And I think that, you know, like a century ago, you have employers and the government uniting to make sure unions can't succeed. The Supreme Court, like the Supreme Court of a century ago, is effectively creating new doctrine that only applies to unions based on the evidently constitutional principle of five Republican judges not liking labor unions.
Right.
And they're not even trying anymore to justify this. They're simply creating new categories of speech and things like this that limit union activity. So there's no question we're in a very hard time. And even within the Democratic Party, unions don't have the kind of voice that they used to. But at the same time, workers are always going to fight for what they believe is right, whether that's in a labor union as you and I conceive of it, or if it's in a different kind of organization, unemployed worker organization, for instance, or some kind of street protest like an Occupy Wall Street kind of thing. You know, you're going to see a variety of different kinds of responses to economic inequality to produce a new future for the working class. And however that actually ends up, the goal has to be then to gain those levers of power to create law and regulation that are going to allow that union movement to succeed, or labor movement, however it articulates itself, to succeed over the long run.
What can be done? I mean, you know, I mean, if we talk about card check versus, let's say, cap and trade, I mean, the difference between those, in my estimation, and I'm not talking in terms of urgency, but I'm talking about in terms of their relationship to power. It seems to me that you pass card check as a Democratic Party and you are doing something that will help you, at least to some extent, stay in office, right? And to retain power in a way that maybe cap and trade wouldn't. Like, there does not seem, you know, we see Republicans take over in 2010 in states across the country, and the first thing they do is they start a campaign to disenfranchise voters, They gerrymander. They appoint someone to the Supreme Court who's going to eviscerate the Voting Rights Act. Like, they're part of their program is the changing of structures to maintain power in a way that, like, card check strikes me as one that theoretically would do the same. There may be others, like, we're going to have a federal right to vote, so to make it harder. How do we get the Democrats to sort of change their perspective on that? There doesn't seem to be a relationship between Democrats' agenda and their maintenance of power.
Well, I think there's a generation of Democratic leadership that needs to go. I mean, I think this is a big part of the problem, is that, you know, the Democratic leadership is very much struggling to understand what they're facing right now. I think that you see a newer generation of Democrats who do increasingly understand what they're facing. And that doesn't even mean by age, but when they were elected. So your Elizabeth Warren's of the world, for instance, is a great example of somebody who does understand these things. But you have institutions and people in power, whether it's Patrick Leahy, who seems clueless about the way that Republicans manipulate judges, Chuck Schumer, Pelosi, that really come up at a period where Democrats were trying to moderate their image in the 80s and in the 90s, and they're close with Wall Street, and their instincts are to move conservative. And it doesn't work. It's pathetic, frankly. And, you know, you see McConnell just playing Schumer like a fiddle over and over again to get these right-wing judges passed. And I think that, you know, this is why, you know, these things are processes. And part of the process, just like it was a years-long process for conservatives to take over the Republican Party and to kick out the figures who would look like Dwight Eisenhower or look like Nelson Rockefeller and start electing people who look like Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan. And it's going to be the same for Democrats. Democrats are simply going to have to continue to organize within the party so that the leaders understand the power that's in, the issues of power that are on the agenda here, and understand that in order to succeed, you have to pass legislation that isn't just going to be, you know, technocratically good, but is actually going to reinforce democratic power in America, like card check, like a federal right to vote, these sorts of things that are going to create a new democratic majority, one that's based on liberty, one that's based on equality, and one that recognizes what we're facing with Republicans. So I think part of the problem is basically a very weak and poor and short-sighted democratic leadership. And I think that creating new leadership and electing new senators and new governors and new representatives who are going to fight for a more progressive future and really understand the power politics at play, that absolutely has to be central to our strategies. And it is, frankly, a decade-long process to do.
Right. All right. Well, lastly, let me ask you this, because I think people should reading about 10 strikes is not a huge hill to climb, but it's incredibly important to get a sense of where what the union trajectory has been in this country, and just the even more importantly, the power of labor. But was there a specific strike as you were looking back on these 10, the Lowell Mill Girls strike, the strike that took place in the lead up to the Civil War of slaves, and others that stuck out for you as being the greatest epitome of the failures of the union movement and also the successes?
Well, you know, in terms of, so the most important strike in all of American history is actually the slaves walking off the plantations during the Civil War that basically take the labor away from Southern planters, undermine the Confederacy, force Lincoln to pass the Emancipation Proclamation. This is an example of a spontaneous labor movement, what the great scholar W.E.B. Du Bois called the slave general strike, that significantly changes the course of history, yet we don't even think of this in terms of labor. But of course, slavery was a labor system. And that is something that is too often not recognized. And so, you know, if we're looking at what the single most important strike is in all of American history, it's really that one. You know, in terms of the labor movement itself, I mean, I think Flint, with the combination of egalitarianism, innovative techniques, and electing people to office who are going to support worker power within the labor movement, that's probably the single most successful strike in American history. And then the greatest failure in all of American history is what I focus on in Chapter 9 of the book, which is Reagan firing the air traffic controllers, where the air traffic controllers go on strike in 1981 after endorsing Reagan for the presidency, thinking that Reagan's going to be on their side, and they go on strike. He busts their union very easily. It really decimates union power in this country. It ends the 1970s, were a great period of strikes where all kinds of workers were standing up for themselves. It closes that dead, and it opens the door for private sector employers to bust their unions. So, you know, kind of building on the Reagan firing the air traffic controllers, I look at the Phelps Dodge strike of 1983, where that, you know, largest mining company in the world closes their Arizona mines and reopens them without unions. And at that point, you have a total war on labor in this country. So really, that's the greatest failure of in all of American history for workers, an utter disaster that we still live with today, because it ushers in the current era of union busting that remains tremendously powerful today, really a central feature of the Republican Party.
Eric Loomis, the book is A History of America in 10 Strikes. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, folks. Fascinating stuff. And he also, we didn't even get to talk about some of the key court cases, but I was really chomping at the bit. But he's got.
That could be your book, The History of Labor in 10 Court
Cases.
I'll
just crib his. He could have probably titled it that. I don't know if there was 10 court cases, but. He had to get to class, but we will put a link to A History of America in 10 Strikes at majority.fm. Folks, a reminder, this program relies on you for its very survival. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. There you'll have the opportunity to join the Majority Report at any number of cleverly titled names for membership, all very similar in terms of what you get for it. Although you know, it would be inappropriate for you to walk around and say, I'm a Cedarista, if you were really a Majority Reporter. That's the only thing that really makes a difference there. But you can head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day on this program. So jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I am looking at our 5-pound bag of Majority Blend right now. And also, Brendan, I, for the life of me, I can't find that other 5-pound bag that we must have drank that.
Probably did.
Well, I mean, we ground it first. All right. Well, we'll talk about that later. But justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Michael, what's happening on Tuesday?
Anoa Changa is going to be on. We're talking about Georgia, voter disenfranchisement, but also the left-wing future of the Southern Democratic Party. Does the Southern Democratic Party have a left future? Yes,
I've interviewed her.
Anoa?
Yeah.
For Ring of Fire?
Somewhere.
Wait, did you meet her at Netroots?
Maybe at the DNC.
Well, she's really smart. Anyways,
I can't remember.
Okay, thank you.
I mean,
you.
I've interviewed.
That was a great intervention.
People.
I appreciate it.
There you go. Check it out, folks.
She's crew.
Tune in to see if I interviewed her.
Yeah, I'll ask. It'll be top questions. So that is happening on Tuesday. And, of course, all the regular segments. I do want to say on Sunday, we did an illicit history of Patrice Lumumba and the factors behind the civil war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, going back to Belgium and all the way to your iPhone. Patreon.com/TMBS. And also, I guess we should mention now again, occasionally on YouTube as well. We have plenty of clips up there.
Maybe it was on Ring of Fire. I'm not sure.
Are you still on this?
Well, I don't know.
You should. Noah's a great guest.
I feel like I have. I don't. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Yeah, so this week was episode 25. We decided to take some questions from our audience, and it elicited some really good conversation. We talked about Comrade Gritty, the new Philadelphia Flyers mascot. That wasn't a question. We just like him. We have some spicy takes on Angela Nagel, witches, and the occult. And one, probably my favorite question was, how often do we question what we believe? So check it out, folks. We also have a patrons-only bonus out now for our patrons about just like extra awesome stuff from our recording session last week with Dr. Jacob Blumenfeld.
Matt?
I concluded the first volume of Hope Leslie by Catherine Maria Sedgwick for patrons. If you want to hear me read an audiobook to you, apparently some people are really enjoying the sound of my voice for 5 hours. It's a very interesting book, though. It's 1827.
You've done 5 hours of recording?
Yep, five whole hours. Well, actually, it takes a lot more than that because you have to...
Yeah, you have to edit it. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm really enjoying it. The book is very interesting. It's a very early American fiction, but it talks about the Pequot War and how that became one of the first, you know, when we talk about ICE and separating kids from families and adoption, how that equals genocide. Well, the Pequot War was one of the first times we did this. We sent the men to the Caribbean, and the women and children stayed here to be domestic servants for the Puritans. So,
wow. So
it's all in there.
What a tradition we have in this country.
Yep.
That's wonderful.
You know, I'm not politically correct.
We have a...
imagine Ben Carson's response.
In lieu of La Poupée today, the members will recognize maybe this singer-songwriter. The pilot season at the end of the member show is a song that was written for a series I did called Pilot Season by a buddy of mine who... the lead singer of the Dam Builders, and more or less the project that he's been doing. He's doing some solo stuff, but Gramercy Arms over the past, I guess, 10, 15 years, he's been doing stuff. And he wrote a song that is, I'll just read what they put on YouTube. This is a song about a man who's about to have his lifelong ambition fulfilled, but he's being accused of something horrible he did in his past. Concerned this could thwart his dream, he reaches out to old friends to make sure they're on the same page in terms of their understanding of the past. He also takes the opportunity to remind them of some compromising information he has on them. Only the names have been changed to protect the insolent. And so this has been inspired by recent events. You'll notice he's drinking some beer in this... they did a quick and down and dirty music video for this song. This is Gramercy Arms and Dave Derby.
And hey, I know it's been a while since we last spoke. I'm just happy that we finally found the time. Please pass along my best to Tanya and the kids. I trust they're doing fine. I guess you probably know what's going on with me and why I'm keeping things a bit on the down low. Most of all, I'm making sure we got our stories straight about what went down so long ago and people we both used to know. Is it certain of your past? I'm looking out for you, that's all, 'cause I'm together. Jenny Alvis from the suite upstairs. She claims it's something awful that I did. Of course we've all got things we're not so proud about. Some things you might want to hear. Say from Tanya and the kids. You know where I'm driving at. We can't be dredging up our past. No one has to take the fall. So here's the tack I'm taking. We were young and dumb, and the memories of that night are just a blur. And even if somebody did the thing she said, in the end it's just her word. I understand that people change, so they say. Our past is something you don't simply just outgrow. And I know you understand, because our fates were sown so many years ago. It's not just what, but who you